This is Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust. Hello, hello. Welcome back to Vulnerability Matters. I'm Chris Fitch. If I ask you what it meant to design something, a service, a product, even a letter, in a trauma-informed way, what would you say? Now, if you're like me, you might stumble a little, perhaps reach for some words about lived experience being key. But ultimately, you might find yourself hesitating. Because after all, isn't trauma something that happens after a really significant event and not something we might experience when filling out an online customer form, paying our everyday bills, or switching energy suppliers? However, today's guest, Rachel Edwards, wants you to think again. Coming across trauma-informed approaches to design herself almost by chance, Rachel has moved on from grappling with the concept at the outset to becoming one of the UK's leading voices on trauma-informed design. So with hundreds of hours of design experience under her belt, I asked Rachel what trauma is, how it affects people, and, even if we still remain a little hesitant about using the word itself, how introducing six simple ideas into our work can make us trauma-informed. Rachel, welcome to Vulnerability Matters. Really, really good to have you here. Let's immediately start with the word trauma. It's a powerful term. So what does it mean?
Oh, that's a really good question. So the sort of the actual meaning of trauma is wound. It comes from a Greek word and it means wound. I think a lot of people have their own ideas of what trauma is and what trauma means, but that is the technical definition is wound. If somebody has a wound, we try and heal it. We don't sort of judge the wound. We don't say it's not really a wound because it was caused by a paper cut, not a knife, or this is a bruise, so it's not actually a wound. A wound is something that hurts, and we want to try and make it better. And my interest in trauma comes from how we design things like websites and content so that it doesn't hurt people. And if somebody has that wound, that we can try and help them heal around it.
But there are different types of trauma, aren't they? Can you run us through some of the categories?
Oh, gosh, there's loads. I'm going to refer to one of my friends and colleagues, Jax Westroller, who writes about different kinds of trauma and what they do to us. And she's written a chapter in a book called Designed with Care that I edited last year. And she has an impressive list of traumas. So I'm just going to run through them, some of them. So she talks about acute trauma, chronic trauma, relational or interpersonal trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, collective trauma, intergenerational trauma, historical trauma, racialized trauma, systemic trauma, vicarious trauma, big T and small T trauma. That's a big shopping list of traumas. And there are lots of different labels and there are lots of different ways that we use that word. Just to touch on a couple of them, big T trauma tends to refer to the things that people generally think of as traumatic, big events that are life-altering things. And the small T trauma is more about repeated exposure to smaller stressors. But one thing that I do is I talk about stress and anxiety as well as trauma. And there's a reason for that. I've found in my work that people don't tend to use the word trauma to talk about themselves. I think certainly in my generation, there's a lot of feelings around the word and around what it means. But I find that people don't really tend to use that word about themselves, and they're much more likely to relate to stress and anxiety. So I tend to use those when I'm talking about different traumas as well.
Absolutely. And it reminds us of the importance of using, if I can call it, backstage language to enable us to think about people's lived experience. I just wanted to ask you kind of first, do we have a sense of how many UK adults, however we define it, live with trauma and how they're affected by it in everyday life?
We've got a kind of general number, which is that over 70% of the world's population has witnessed or lived through a traumatic event. I got interested in this because of the impact that stress hormones have on people trying to take in information. And I am a content designer, and that means basically that I try and make information that people can understand. And what that means is that they can read it, they can understand it, they can access it if they're using something like a screen reader. So there's lots of kind of technical things. But the bit that really interests me is when somebody is stressed or has experienced trauma or re-traumatization, their body gets flooded with stress hormones. And those stress hormones make it harder to read, to take in information, to understand, to make decisions. So if you think about this in a kind of real life context, if, for example, you've just been given a medical diagnosis that isn't a great one, and at that moment, your doctor is also giving you lots of information and telling you what's going to happen next, and maybe you've had this experience, and you then leave the room and you have no idea what was just said because your brain is so overwhelmed and so flooded with these stress hormones that you're not taking things in. So my interest is, how do we make information for people that, first of all, tries to keep them safe so that they don't get that rash of stress hormones? And second, so that we give it to them in small enough chunks that they can digest it and take it in. So that's how I got into this. And that's a very long answer to how it affects people. But I'm sure, you know, you'll probably have experienced this. Your listeners will have experienced this, that when you get really stressed, you just can't focus and pay attention in the same way that you normally would. And it doesn't matter how smart you are to start with. When these things happen, it is quite difficult to concentrate and to take in information.
Now, you said stress first led you into this area of trauma-informed design. So it's was there a particular project that maybe stands out in your work through trauma-informed design that really brings the concept to life, something you could share with us?
Yeah, the first project where I really worked on this and that I really got interested in was a government service for people who had been abused in care. And I was really lucky to join the team that was working on the sort of web content and the application forms and the guidance for this scheme. And when I joined them, they had already committed to working using trauma-informed principles. And so I came in to basically do the words, to write the application form and the guidance. Nobody really knew what trauma-informed principles would look like in that context. So that's where I kind of started exploring, well, what do these principles mean if we take them into the written word? Trauma-informed principles and practice were developed to be used sort of person to person. So somebody speaking to somebody, somebody working with somebody. And so there's a lot of, you know, ways that you can adapt your behavior and your approach based on that other person. How do you do that with a written word, with a paper, like a literal piece of paper that has words on it? How can you bring those principles? So that's where I started. What I came to realize after I left that project is it's actually applicable to everything. And I do mean everything. I was speaking to someone quite early on in my work on this, and they said, well, it's not relevant if someone's switching gas suppliers, is it? And I said, no, you're right. It's not for that. And then I went away and I thought about it, and I was like, well, actually, who am I to say that it's not for that? Because I don't know why that person's switching their gas suppliers. I don't know what else is going on in their life at that time. So sometimes the projects that I work on, it's really overt. You know there's going to be trauma. And again, using the word lucky, but I don't mean lucky. You'll be lucky enough to know where that trauma has come from and sort of find patterns between the people who are using that service. Other times, you know nothing about the people who are coming to your content, but it is safe to assume that those people will, at least some of them, will be stressed, will be anxious, will have experienced trauma, may be going through something in their life completely unrelated to your information. I talk a lot about my recent experience in the last couple of years because I've been working on this for quite a few years now, and I've been talking to groups and to organizations about what stress does to your brain. And then one of my children last year was diagnosed with cancer, and we lived in the children's hospital for about 5 months. And as you can imagine, when your life changes like that in a minute and you go to living in hospital, you are full of stress. So suddenly I was living this thing that I had been talking about. And I remember I had to find my child some pajamas that worked with the various drips. And so I Googled pajamas that button down the front, and I looked at my phone and I could not understand what I was looking at. So I had to ask a friend, can you Google pajamas for me and send me a few that I can buy? And so if you were designing content for somebody selling pajamas, this is not the kind of thing that you're going to think, oh, I must consider trauma. But you don't know what the person who is coming to your content is going through. So it is applicable to everything, to every situation, maybe not to every person at every moment, but it's always something that you need to be thinking about.
And I mean, firstly, thanks for sharing that. I think it's really what really comes across in what you've been talking about is it may not be specifically the circumstance, but it's thinking about those emotional states that humans find themselves in, which are common and universal across a range of adverse experiences, whether they're adverse experiences in the past or in the present, or perhaps even kind of a foreseeable and are being triggered by what they're encountering. And I think that also that emphasis much earlier you mentioned about thinking about the written word and translating the experience of others, be they clinicians or therapists, into our work in a way which is meaningful and relevant. It's a really strong picture I think you're giving there of a trauma-informed design. So on the other side of the coin, what does trauma-uninformed design look like? Or is that just everything that kind of maybe exists now?
Oh, it's a really good question. I like that trauma-uninformed design. I think when I've seen that sort of happen, one of the common pitfalls would be prioritizing business needs and the way we've always done things over the possibility that the people coming to your service or your content might be experiencing trauma. So I did some work for a charity that worked with people who were experiencing addiction. And one of the things that they had on a form for people to refer themselves for help was a lot of open text questions, or free text sort of responses. So basically asking a really general wide question and then giving people open space to fill it in. And this might seem a bit counterintuitive, because I think we tend to think that if somebody has a trauma or a negative experience in their past, that it's good for them to talk about it and to get it off their chest. And in certain settings, in certain circumstances, it is. You know, if you're talking to a therapist or counselor or support group, somebody who's there who can support you with that, that's a great thing. But if you are doing that on a website, in a text box, that's not a good thing. You know, somebody could spend 45 minutes writing their life story out, and then they're going to hit a submit button and nothing happens. And they've then, you know, revisited this past trauma. They possibly got themselves into an elevated state and they're not getting any support. So it can be quite a negative thing for somebody to do. But from a business sense, they said, well, we leave it open and then people tell us things and then we get to know them a bit more and to understand a bit about their addiction journey. And, you know, it kind of makes sense, but it's not prioritizing the safety of the user. It's prioritizing the way things have always been done and what the business needs. So I think those would be things that I say are general kind of warning signs about trauma uninformed design. And I think the other thing would just be viewing trauma as an edge case, not something that's relevant to your users. Well, our users are not people who've experienced this. They probably are. So I think if it's dismissed straight away as not something we need to consider, then that would be trauma uninformed design risk.
That's really helpful. Now you've touched already on one of the six guiding principles that underpin a trauma-informed approach. And I think we're going to just walk through those. And those six are safety, trust, choice, collaboration, empowerment, and cultural considerations. I hope I got them right, because I've been reading your book. But now people listening might be thinking, hey, come on, I know what safety, trust, choice, etc. means. But I wonder if you could just help bring them to life from a slightly perhaps different angle, make us revisit the familiar, starting perhaps with safety.
Let's do it. And I should say, other principles are available as well. This is the framework that I tend to go back to. It's one of the original ones. There are others, and some organizations will adapt it slightly or revisit these principles. They do tend to have these common themes, so they might just have slightly different words. So this is the one that I use. Others are available, but safety is a great place to start, and it's probably, I think, safety and trust, just to jump right in there, are the two ones that I would say you must always be thinking about. So safety in terms of content, it can be things like a quick exit button or a leave this page button, which you might find on sites that support people who are in vulnerable situations so that they can quickly get off that page if they need to. It might involve things like content warnings, so telling people what sort of content is going to be coming up. But safety can also just be about making sure your information is understandable. So if you're talking about things like, for example, medication dosages or dates, times, and directions, those things can literally be life-saving if they're understood. So those are a few things to think about for safety.
Trust. How would we unpack that a little more?
Oh, yeah, trust. Trust is a big one because there are a lot of things that you can do for trust. So one of the things, if you're presenting written content, a web page, something like that, make sure that it looks accurate and professional. Things like spelling mistakes. I don't mean to sound like your high school English teacher, but if you've got things that are inconsistent, that don't look finished, you know, links that don't work, that is all going to create a sort of subtle sense of distrust. So make sure that your content looks good and works well. Another big thing is about how you structure it. So there are certain major online businesses where if you try and contact customer service, it'll take you ages to try and find a way through, and you're likely to never find your way back to that again. So things like hiding your contact information or making it difficult to find, that's not going to build trust. What you can do is be really clear about next steps, about timescales, about who you contact and how. And another thing that I found really important is if you're asking for information, can you explain why you're asking for it and what you're going to do with it? So, for example, if you're asking for someone's marital status, why do you need that information? Where's it going and who's going to see it? And if you make that upfront, that will build trust. And especially if you're asking things that might be very personal or very awkward, explain why you're asking and don't collect information just for the sake of it.
Your third principle is choice, and your fourth is collaboration. Do you want to just lead us through those?
Yeah, sure. So choice isn't always possible, but if it is possible, let people know what their choices are. So that could be things like options for support. You can call or you can email if you need help. That's giving people some choice. It could be choice around languages and formats of information. It could be choice around, you know, appointment locations and times. But when people are in vulnerable situations, there is a power imbalance, whether it's real or it's perceived. So any little choices that you can give back to someone is going to give them a bit of that power back. And again, I remember when my child was in hospital and there were so many things that we didn't have choice about. But any time that they could get a choice and could actually make that for themselves, that was really helpful to kind of shift that power imbalance again. So choice is a great one. You, like I say, you can't always give choice, and don't give false choices either. Collaboration is a tricky one too, because in my work, we like to collaborate by testing things with people who might be using a service or using that piece of content. We like to work with them as much as possible. But when you're working with people who are in vulnerable situations, that's not always going to be appropriate. It could harm them. So you want to collaborate where possible. But that might not always be possible with people who are directly impacted. There are things that you can do. You can use proxy users, so things like charities that might work with those people, or if they're liaison officers, they might be a better place to go, because you don't, as much as it's helpful to collaborate, you don't want to risk harming someone. That said, when the conditions are right, collaboration can be a really great way of redressing some of that power imbalance. And you'll find a lot of people who've gone through a negative thing, a bad thing, will want to try and make it better for other people. That's a really common thing that you hear. So giving people those opportunities to collaborate, to improve things, to say what they found difficult and what would make it better, that can be a really good thing. You've just got to be careful and think about how you're doing it and how you're supporting those people.
The fifth and sixth principles are really interesting. We've got empowerment and then cultural considerations. Can you give us those in a nutshell, Rachel?
Yeah, so empowerment, again, if you're thinking about redressing that power imbalance, anything you can do to empower someone is great. And this should be easy to do in some ways, because for me and my work as a content designer, it's about making information people can understand. So if you read a paragraph and you can't understand it and you don't know what you're supposed to do, and you need to ask for help, or you need to reread it, or you just give up, that is disempowering. If you have something that is clear, that is easy to navigate, that you can understand and you know what you're meant to do and can act independently, that is empowering. So that is what kind of aiming for. And again, that can bring in things like making sure that it works with assistive technology, so that somebody who maybe uses a screen reader can fill in a personal information form without having to ask somebody for help and having to disclose things that they might not want to. So empowerment is very central to my work as a content designer and something that I really think we should always try to do in our content. Cultural, gender, and historical considerations, to give it the full title. It might be things like considering different languages, different formats, service times that take into account different cultural factors. It might be about avoiding generalizations that are based on one particular demographic and their needs. But it might also be about recognizing the sort of historical context of a community or a group, and bringing that into your content as well.
What other resources could we consult to find out a bit more about you and your work, Rachel?
Well, the big one is a book that I edited last year, which I've already mentioned a few times. It's called Designed with Care, Creating Trauma-Informed Content. And it was written by 15 of us from around the world and covers a whole range of different things related to content and user-centered design. So it's got chapters on things like vicarious trauma, which we haven't actually touched on today, on doing research with people who've experienced trauma, content warnings, that's my contribution. So I hope it's useful, and it's available on Amazon, but we also have a website, which is designedwithcare.org, and that has some chapters available for free. What it also has is a list of all the resources that are mentioned in the book, and they are all hyperlinked. So if you want to do more reading, just navigate to the references page and you will see everything that we refer to, and it will give you a whole lot of things to think about. Trauma-informed practice, there's a lot written about it. Applying it to content design is much newer. So it's an emerging field. And in the last few years, I'm just so pleased to see how many people have started talking about it. But yeah, the book and the resources, it's a good place to start.
Lovely. Rachel Edwards, thank you very much. And that was Rachel Edwards, encouraging us to think about trauma as a core part of lived experience and design. So do go and get the book that Rachel mentioned. I bought my own copy from designedwithcare, or one word, .org, and it's a really impressive and most importantly practical piece of work. And that's it for this episode. So until next time we meet, stay informed, think trauma, and always remember that vulnerability matters. Thank you. Vulnerability Matters was produced by Amandy McGreevy and Phil King and brought to you by the Money Advice Trust.